Welcome to the New Zealand Tech Podcast, presented by Paul Spain and guests.
Welcome along to the New Zealand Tech Podcast. We're at episode number 142. You're with Paul Spain,
Bill Bennett,
and Alistair Cook.
Welcome along, guys. It's great to have you both here.
Hi, Paul.
Good to be back after such a long absence.
Yeah, it's been a while. When were you last on, Alistair?
Back when it was about episode number 67, I think.
Wow.
Long time ago.
I can't remember that long ago. Must have just been a small child. It sounds like years ago. Now, Alistair, just remind us where you fit into the technology community in New Zealand.
So I work in enterprise IT, particularly around virtualization with VMware products, both teaching and consulting and writing for TechTarget about that.
Excellent. And Bill?
Well, I'm just moving to a new life where I'm running a technology news agency called Digital. That's digital without the A.co.nz. Should be up and running by the end of this month. We're doing a bit of a soft launch at the moment, so there's a few stories appearing now.
End of which month? August or July?
Oh, sorry, end of August.
Yeah, I was thinking that we're just on the edge tonight, aren't we?
Yeah. And I'm working on that with the guys from Geek Zone and Scoop.
Excellent. All right, so we'll be seeing a lot more of your content going forward.
I hope
in New Zealand, because you've been writing a lot for Australian media and so on as well, right? So this puts the focus very much on your own property in conjunction with Geek Zone and Scoop for sharing the content out there.
Yeah, my focus is very much on New Zealand as well.
Great. Oh, that's good. Well, let's jump in. As always, there's a few bits and pieces to cover. Now, first up, there was a bit of a story yesterday, with some websites going offline.
The government ones, or ones related to the government.
Yeah, yeah, we did John Key's website and a range of other MPs, National MPs' websites went down. Now, we heard that these were all hosted on one particular server, I believe, so it was, wasn't particularly hard by the sounds of it for these to be taken offline. And those who were claiming responsibility were Anonymous NZ, who we've never heard of before, and we don't know and would presume they wouldn't have any relation to the Anonymous hackers group sort of globally, but I guess piggybacking on their name.
Kim.com wasn't very happy with them.
No, he was sort of tweeting saying, hey, this actually isn't helpful to his cause. And in fact, they were asking for an apology to be made to all New Zealanders and to Kim.com by the government in order for them to bring these websites back online again. What was that about? Hasn't John Key already apologised to Kim.com?
Yeah, I think he has. But the thing is that The problem is they're actually attacking... Well, it's not so much they're attacking the wrong target, but the way they're going about this isn't helpful, because actually they're perpetuating the myths that worry the people that are worried and doing this stuff. So
right, because they've attached this to the GCSB bill, and do you think this may have a negative consequence, or do you think it's just something that's going to fly by and not have too much attention unless they keep doing it? I mean, if we keep seeing constant things happening,
look, the smart thing for the government, the smart thing for the government, the ministers to have done would have been to ignore it and just shrug it off as no big deal. I don't think they're helping their cause by reacting either, but that's the nature of these things.
Any thoughts there, Alistair? Did you think this was a good or a bad thing?
I kind of feel like it's some people who are being naughty children, and that the best response to naughty children is to ignore the naughty things. The more attention you give somebody for doing something naughty, the more they'll do it. So even us talking about it is probably encouraging these people who I think also, like you, I think they've been independent, not affiliated with anywhere else, and not doing any particularly aggressive attacks. Let's not give them any more encouragement to upscale things.
Yeah, and it's not the kind of fabulously exciting technology they're using to do the attacks, which means they're all going to get great jobs in security for the rest of their lives, does it?
I wouldn't say it was a career positive move to align with this.
Well, I guess that's why there's a reason to stay anonymous in all of this. Now, internet connectivity to New Zealand. It's something that we, you know, we discuss from time to time. Now, you know, both the connectivity from our homes and mobile devices to the internet, and the connectivity between New Zealand and the rest of the world. Now, Bill, there's been, I guess, a couple of stories in relation to that this week. One with the Southern Cross cable, and one with another potential cable. Maybe you can fill us in. I did read the piece you put up on digital.co.nz this week around the Southern Cross cable. So maybe start with that.
Well, the Southern Cross made a press release went out from Southern Cross today, and it's the first press release I think since about September last year, which is kind of a bit of a coincidence considering that Hawaiki made their announcement yesterday about landing their cable in Whangarei. Clearly, there's some politics and some PR positioning and so on going on around there. And there's a bit of a question mark over what Southern Cross actually announced. They talked about their new technology, which increases the capacity of their cable. Well, that's always been on the cards. I mean, they talked about that a year ago about that coming, and that they now say that's implemented, which takes their network up, I think, to 12 terabits per second across the Pacific. That's plenty for the next 5 or 6 years for New Zealand. The last time we looked, I think we're still only running about 10% of the potential capacity of that network. So we're not closing down on that number. But the reason why people are so interested in there being another cable is, well, because they need another cable, because we've got a monopoly provider, which doesn't appear to be abusing their monopoly on price, but it does mean there's... And it's not a single point of failure in technical terms, because they've got two lines in, but three lines into New Zealand, or four lines into New Zealand, or eight lines into New Zealand is a lot safer than
would
two.
Would be safer. I mean, it seems at the moment we do hear noises of people saying, "Oh, my international internet performance is poor. That's Southern Cross's fault." But I mean, I find certainly if you're using a major internet provider, then usually they've got adequate bandwidth for most sorts of things. There are some technical challenges with distance that mean for, you know, streaming video and other types of things.
Gamers, I think,
you know, big downloads. Yeah. It's much better if the data is coming from a closer location. That's right, isn't it? You're a lot more clued up on probably these IP subjects than me, Alistair.
Looking at long distance kind of latency and throughput discussions, and as Bill says, you can't change the speed of light. Latency goes up as you get further away. So getting to a game server in the US, your latency is going to be high, and that's why Kim.com has made so much effort for his internet connectivity, and I believe was going to fly a guy down here to make sure it wasn't a latency issue that was the difference between him being the champion and Kim being the champion. But the element, I think, here is that as Paul says, that's often down to the ISP to contract for a certain amount of bandwidth, and then to decide how much to overcommit to that bandwidth against the number of people that they have. Not just, we're used to that idea of the exchange that I'm in has a limited amount of bandwidth, and there are 400 people using the same exchange is going to give me less bandwidth than if there are only 20. I live really rural, so these small numbers count. The same applies when the ISP itself has aggregated lots and lots of people's connections into one place, which is their central provision set of bandwidth to overseas. The more they buy relative to the number of users they have, the better they're going to be. But they do long-term contracts, and so if there's a sudden bulge, they get really successful at selling a new product, the amount of bandwidth they've got for overseas doesn't go up instantly.
We've seen that happen in the past with the likes of Orcon, I think, where they had some real issues for a period of time.
Those unlimited plans are famous for that. The other thing is the way that the ISPs buy bandwidth is they actually they don't go shopping for bandwidth at Southern Cross. What happens is there are aggregators who buy a whole bundle of bandwidth and then sell it to the ISPs. So there is a bit of flexibility there. But you're right, the problems are not the cable. The problems are the way people are buying bandwidth on the cable.
And to a certain extent, you get what you pay for.
Yeah,
if you buy a cheap service, you should expect to get lower quality. If you pay significantly more, and often it is significantly more to get a good quality service, then you should be expecting to get that better quality.
That's right. But the thing about the new cable is to say it's not really about the extra bandwidth that it'll provide. There'll actually be quite a lot. I think it's 20 terabits per second connection.
Putting that in perspective in terms of throughputs, if every household in the country had an ultra-fast broadband connection, we still wouldn't be filling those pipes.
No, that's
so, you know, there's other places where the bandwidth is consumed. Obviously, lots of business bandwidth is high, but this is vast amounts of bandwidth already available to us, and the redundancy and security of these links starts to be what we see as being the benefit of having more of them.
Yeah, and that's absolutely vital. I mean, we you know, if there's a 1 in 1,000 chance of one going down, then there's a 1 in 1,000,000 chance of two going down. Well, 1 in 1,000,000 chance, you wouldn't bank your life on a 1 in 1,000,000 chance. We shouldn't bank our economy on a 1 in 1,000,000 chance.
Well, the way the statistics work, there's actually a vastly higher than 1 in 1,000,000 chance.
I know.
And the other thing I noticed about the announcement on this cable.
Theoretical numbers.
Yeah. The other thing I noticed about the announcement on this cable that I thought was really cool was that there was taps coming off the cable to a lot of the Pacific Islands that currently have very little bandwidth available, and that could be a huge enabler.
Yeah, and I think that'll be good for New Zealand as well. I think it'll make us closer to those islands as well,
particularly since many people in New Zealand have family still in those islands.
Yeah.
and possibly leave the islands because the employment opportunities aren't necessarily as good, and maybe this will help to make better.
I would think it would have to be good for for some of the Pacific Island economies. I mean, there is already some connectivity, having another series of connections like this would be great. Now, I did just look up some figures. Now, the Southern Cross cables were upgraded to 1.2 terabits in May 2010, and they've just gone to 2.4 terabits as the new connection, I believe.
But but Southern Cross is saying their total capacity is now 12.
Yeah, and I think that's when you break it down, because you've got two ways of getting to Australia and the US and so on, and between those different segments, if you add them all up, you could say in total from one point to the next point, and then that point to the next point, sort of thing. But it's a huge amount of bandwidth. That's fairly certain. But you need that for a big country, particularly as we increase our usage going forward.
And I remember talking to the guys from Mega not so long ago in the last couple of weeks, and they said that their business that now has more bandwidth than the whole of New Zealand, which kind of puts us into perspective a bit.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to get a breakdown, a little bit more detail on that particular statement, and that's probably something we can hit them up for. If they're doing as well as the old Mega Upload was doing, then it would be considerably more than New Zealand's capacity, because they were taking up a reasonably sizable chunk of the global internet capacity. All right, now moving along, a few other topics. We have a new podcast launching this week in New Zealand, the New Zealand Business Podcast. So there's going to be a range of topics on that. So if you're in the business world, we encourage you to listen in and to check that out. There will be some episodes that are in some way similar to our NZ Tech Podcast episodes, with general sort of roundtable discussions. Other times we will sit in and capture particular events that we think might be interesting. And there'll be one-on-one chats with entrepreneurs and business people and so on. And sometimes there'll be content that may have been in the NZ Tech Podcast that we think might be of interest to a broader tech audience. So one of the episodes we've got captures our discussion with Rod Drury from Xero from a few weeks ago, and that's going to be wrapped up and delivered to the business podcast audience. But I know a lot of our listeners may not be so interested in the business podcast, but they might know people that are in business and should be listening. So any help that you can give us in spreading the word on that would be much appreciated.
You need to have an American accent and say something. And now a word from our sponsors.
No, stop that. We're Kiwis here. Now, Vodafone, they've been quietly, well, not so quietly, actually. They've been bumping their network speeds up around the country. And I think they've hit their sixth location. And our mighty capital, Wellington, has finally got 4G this week. And they've done their little announcement after, what do we got? Auckland came on track first. Mm. We've had Christchurch,
Queenstown,
Wanaka.
Lake Brunner,
was it? And now Wellington.
Taupo.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. So, so that's good. I think we've got to be... I'm sure they're mindful that October is when Telecom starts rolling out their 4G or LTE network. So, they're trying to make as much noise and get as much attention for that as possible.
I have to say it's bloody fast. Am I allowed to say bloody fast? It's well, very fast.
You've said it, haven't you?
It's very fast. It's actually faster than I get broadband at home across ADSL, so extremely fast.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it? And we were talking earlier before we started that in time we are going to get these bigger data caps, and they talk about all the things you can do on a 4G LTE connection. Often it's talked about, streaming movies and so on. Now, there's not too much of that you would do on the current data caps, but 4G will become the norm over time, and I'm guessing the premium that we pay for that service at the moment will ultimately drop off, and it will become available certainly for all of their business customers. And we've seen this in other markets where maybe prepaid customers don't get access to the full, the full speed, certainly not initially. But business customers will get that. At the moment, I think you're paying, unless you're on one of their top $120 up plans, you're paying an extra $10 a month for access to that. But it is really nice having those top speeds, and it's great to see New Zealand staying reasonably at the forefront on these things. We're not too far behind US and Australia. A little bit behind, but not a decade behind. Anyway.
It's very interesting the way that it's been deployed in Wellington, because it's pretty much on the flat bits and up the Hutt Valley. You can get it at some various points around the harbour, probably, I don't know, Days Bay, but places like that around the harbour are covered.
Well, I guess they pick the spots that are easiest to implement to start with in some ways. And if you've got a simpler topology, then there's less... probably less effort in many ways to get it running in those places. You reach a bigger audience, I would think.
Yeah, I saw a demonstration of the technology about probably more than 2 years ago now, when it was really was just a demonstration of what was possible at the time, and they had 2 3D TVs running across the network. Mm-hmm. That's quite impressive, actually.
Yeah, it is good. And the thing that we forget is, 4G was a technology that was mooted for a long, long time. And the LTE standard that most of the world is going to now is, streets ahead of some of the stuff that they were talking about a decade ago. In fact, even, the variants of 3G we've got now are actually really, really fast.
Yeah.
So the 4G or LTE, as the technology is called, is pretty fantastic, actually. Now, looking at gadgets, there's been a bit of coverage in the, particularly in the US media, around Google's new Nexus 7 tablet. Now, of course, they launched their first one last year, and we bought one of those back from the US, because it took some time before it got into the New Zealand market, and was priced quite a bit higher here, actually. But it was a reasonably a standout device when the first Nexus 7 came out. But the new one is attracting a whole fresh round of attention. Now, it's not Google that actually makes it. I think it's made by Asus again, who made the first one last year. And we're talking about a little 7-inch tablet that has a pretty stunning screen. You're talking slightly more than full high definition on that screen, which we have seen on smartphones, but it's coming in at a pretty sharp starting price point of $199 before tax. What do you guys think of this from a pricing perspective? Ah, no, actually, I'm reading here $229. Which of those figures is correct?
It'll depend on the wirelesses, the wireless capabilities that are built in, whether the LTE is built into it, whether it's the 16 or 32 gig.
Oh, hold on, no. When it was launched last year, it was $199. The new model starts at $229 for a 16 gigabyte model with Wi-Fi, and $269 for a 32 gig Wi-Fi model, and then there are going to be variants with 4G LTE coming as well, so in varying price points by the sounds of it. So, but a reasonably sharply priced device, and it's got it's the first tablet I think we've seen with wireless charging in it, right?
Yeah, are people buying tablets with built-in 4G? I mean, I got a Wi-Fi one, and I just use it with my phone. I thought that's what most people do these days.
Yeah, I think it does vary. There is definitely a demand, and I like that convenience of having it built in. But I must say, I've tended to use the built-in connections much less with now that the tethering capabilities of most phones are really good. But it does come in part way down to your battery life and how much you're going to use it, and how much you use it out and about. Most of the time, I'm using a tablet. I'm in the office, or at home, or at another location where there is where there is Wi-Fi, because Wi-Fi is becoming so ubiquitous.
That's kind of my point. I mean, I think I've had to tether my tablet probably twice in the last 6 months. I had to tether my laptop once in the last 6 months. So you know what I'm saying? It's not that often you're away from Wi-Fi when you're using a tablet. Or at least I'm not.
Mm.
So I think the Wi-Fi ones will fly. Pretty much like I think the Wi-Fi other tablets fly.
Yeah, I think that's the bulk of the market. Now, a couple of interesting things about the Nexus 7. It's got the next version of Android on it, 4.3, that was released last week. They're still calling it Jelly Bean, so they haven't given it a new name with this this update. And one of the standout features with this release is what they're calling restricted profiles, and it allows you basically have multiple user accounts that can use that one tablet. And we've seen that with Windows 8 and 8.1, and that has been one of the, I guess, its differentiators as opposed to as it competes with Android and with iOS on the iPad. But now we're seeing Google move pretty swiftly here to give you those sorts of those sorts of things, having these different profiles. So looks interesting. That screen is really pretty high definition. And I think we're talking about a 5-megapixel rear camera, so a reasonable quality camera for a tablet. They don't tend to have as good cameras as we see on our smartphones, which is fair enough considering how cheap these tablets are. Next to a phone, they're a fraction of the price, and a 1.2 megapixel forward-facing camera on this one. So, looks nice. Either of you interested in the Nexus 7? Do you like to use a small tablet, Alistair?
I really like my Nexus 7, so I picked one up pretty much a week after they arrived in New Zealand. Impulse buy because it was priced at the kind of space where you can do that. It's not to spend a month thinking through the decision, and used it solidly, really liked it. One of the cool things about this size of tablet is that it fits in the back pocket of my jeans. And you can't say that about the iPad that was out at the time. The huge screen resolution on this is going to be an interesting thing, because once you get to these really high resolutions, it becomes irrelevant, the resolution, unless you're holding the thing very close. And that's the whole point about the Retina display, was that you couldn't pick out at normal distance. You couldn't pick out the pixels. This particular display is over 300 pixels per inch, and so that's even higher pixel density than the your iPhone 4, your Retina iPhone. And so to see the pixels, you'd have to hold it much closer to your face. Don't see myself holding a 7-inch screen 2 inches from my face.
No, I passed on the Nexus, but then we all know what I think about Android tablets.
Yeah, we'll leave it there on that one. Otherwise, we'll get into a huge debate. Now, a couple of other gadgets that we've looked at recently. One that we all just looked at about an hour ago was Netgear's new push-to-TV wireless display adapter.
Yeah.
Now, this is a it's smaller than a smartphone, just a little device. You power it with a USB connection, although it seemed we weren't getting quite enough power out of the TV's USB connection to drive it. But you basically plug in a USB into one side, HDMI into the other, and what you are able to do is to push or mirror the screen off your laptop, your tablet, or your smartphone onto your TV screen. And this is the best I've seen of these devices. And we've been trying them out for a couple of years, but it works really, really broadly. So with, for instance, a lot of the Windows 8 devices, when they upgrade to Windows 8.1, which has the Miracast support built into it, which is one of the technologies that push to TV from Netgear supports, you will basically just be able to take what's on your screen and just treat it as though you've actually plugged in a second monitor, except there's no wire. So it uses those same options that you would normally use within Windows to sort of control a projector or another monitor connection. And it seemed pretty snappy, right, guys?
It seemed on Windows, it seemed to work very well.
Yeah, it was a lovely piece of kit.
Yeah,
we used it on the Android device as well.
Yeah.
What was your pick on that? Was the quality?
That seemed to have some artifacting in it. It just didn't quite seem to cope as well as the Windows build. Now, that may well just be down to an update required from the software on the Android device.
But still impressive. Oh, and, yes. I guess it's one of these things, it's an interim device. At some point, that technology will be built directly into TVs and so on.
Well, and there are some TVs that already have that built in, the Miracast support.
But they tend to just support either Miracast or WiDi, and that's one of the cool things about this device supporting both.
That's
true. I think when there is a single standard for it, a single chipset that supports all the standards, that's when you'll see it in every TV.
Mm. But it's a lovely thing to have.
Well, I look forward to the day when I can turn up at my hotel room, because I spend a lot of time staying in hotels with my work, and I don't have to take a big laptop, and I can take something small but still use the big screen.
Yeah, well, I guess you can take one of these right now. I think they're I'm not sure about
small enough to take with me, because it looked to be about sort of 5 credit cards in size. You stack up 5 credit cards, that's the size of the thing.
It's not that big, isn't it? I think $80 was the international pricing. So I haven't actually checked the New Zealand pricing yet, but I'm picking we're going to be talking, 120 or so within the New Zealand market. Certainly unlikely to be more than 150, including GST. So reasonably affordable. I mean, there are a range of these devices, these types of products around, but this one is nice and small and pretty convenient. I have just seen some pricing for it, and it's available at retailers like Noel Leeming for $100. So actually, that's pretty reasonable pricing for New Zealand market.
That's marginally over the exchange rate difference.
Yeah.
Well, and then you've got to add on GST. So once you cover that, it's actually certainly under the US retail. So, that looks good. Thoroughly recommended based on our few minutes with it.
Brief experience.
I guess the key thing, using the Miracast technology rather than WiDi that I've used on laptops before, on Ultrabooks, it just seemed to be more reliable at connecting. And that's using the beta of Windows 8.1. I found Y-Dice is sometimes a bit flaky. So, yeah, quite pleased with that. Now, Samsung, there have been some rumours floating around about smartwatch coming to market from Samsung fairly soon. Do we need smartwatches?
Do you?
I think that it's something that I want, but I don't need. And I suspect that it's something that after 6 months of owning it will go in a drawer and I'd never worry
about. People said that about the iPad, remember? And look at how broad tablets are now.
No, yeah. I don't agree. I see smartwatches as being hugely successful when they first go on sale for precisely those kinds of reasons that everyone will think, we'll have a look at this. You know, this could make a difference. This could be great. I think they'll be one of those things which are a flash in the pan. They'll be around for a year or so, maybe a bit longer, and then we'll all be bored and move on. Yeah. And I think the evidence of that is what happened with mobile phones. Mobile phones got smaller and smaller and smaller, and then suddenly we started getting smartphones, and they got bigger and bigger and bigger. And why did they get bigger and bigger and bigger? Because we wanted the bigger screens. And I reckon that, you know, a screen that's an inch across or an inch and a half across, whatever it is, whatever the non-metric size of these things will be, will pretty soon pale for a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, I think the experiences so far have been disappointing, but you know, I don't know what they're actually going to come out with. So I'm keeping an open mind on this one.
I've got an open mind, but do you know what I think? I think the gadget manufacturers, they're headless chooks. They're running around. They're looking at all sorts of things like glasses and watches and so on.
Well, I think glasses would probably supersede a watch. Would be my pick.
Yeah, but I still think these are all interim devices. I think they're all
You can be plugged into the wireless matrix.
Wow.
And I think, Paul, you see the glasses form factor work because you routinely wear glasses. I don't.
Yeah.
And so the glasses form factor will be a bigger intrusion for me than a watch. So I think there's potential for multiple ways of having this secondary device to your secondary device.
I think so, but I think that we're heading towards something and we're not sure where it's going.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
This ground is not finished.
Yeah.
The other thing is that smartwatches are not new. If you've got a bit of grey hair hanging around, you'll remember the spot watch there was another one where you held the watch up to the screen and you got something that looked like static on the screen would transfer data to it.
And I had one in about 1982 which had Space Invaders on the watch.
Oh, those were really cool. Those were cool. One other gadget that it's been around for a while, but we only just got it in here a few weeks ago, and how would you describe it? Does it look like an eye on a stick?
It looks like a miniature eye of Sauron.
Yeah, actually, that's absolutely true. Now, what we're talking about is Logitech's BCC950. Now, a difficult name to remember, but basically this is their little video conferencing camera. And you know, I guess a lot of meeting rooms and boardrooms and so on, they've got these little audio conferencing phones which sit around on the desk and so on and get used from time to time. And often those things are $1,000, $1,500, $2,000 units. Now I've been trying the Logitech conference camera out in a couple of meetings and using them as an audio conferencing unit and also with the video camera, and it's actually very, very good. You can have someone sitting a reasonable distance away, and it works in a similar manner to those conferencing devices, but using things like Skype or Link for its video conferencing or audio conferencing capabilities, and you can sit a reasonable distance away, picks it up well, not having any feedback issues.
They're going to be all the rage once we get UFB.
Mm. Well, it's going to become more normal, isn't it? And you do need that faster upload to make video conferencing work well. So now we've got VDSL becoming a really common internet connection option within New Zealand with upload speeds that have gone from what we've been limited to for years and years at 1 megabit to 10 megabits, and then obviously ultra fast broadband, able to deliver, you know, much more than that, but you know, 10 on the basic plans. This sort of device does start to become much more useful, and I think the price point of it is around $400 in New Zealand. So
I just saw a list of under 300.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So,
well, that's what we need. We need consumer devices to make video conferencing work. I mean, you could do video conferencing quite nicely off of most laptops.
Yeah, you can do it quite well with it built in. But if you want to put a few people around a table and so on, this is a sort of device that
you need the noise cancelling microphones and those
makes
kinds
it much
of
more practical. Yeah, yeah. And particularly if you're not all gathered around that little laptop microphone,
which is a bit dodgy.
Yeah, and there are some good webcams as well that have more advanced sort of noise cancelling, cancelling out the echoes and so on type microphones. But this definitely sort of stood out for me in the testing.
And the full HD cam also makes quite a lot of difference in terms of the quality of doing a video conference. Being able to actually see expressions rather than seeing blurs where people are, if you've got a group of people.
Oh, we have that issue because my children are overseas and we do FaceTimes and Skypes and so on to them in Paris, and you get a lot of that blurring. And
of course, if you're on a limited bandwidth plan or limited throughput, it starts to pixelate.
Well, I think we're good our end. I think it's their end. It's rubbish.
Kids overseas, they'll be using the cheapest internet provider they can find, and they can't blame the Southern Cross cable for that.
In Paris, they all get free Wi-Fi, which they steal because people chalk the Wi-Fi passwords up on the street corners.
That's great. Well, I wish all communications were more modern. My phone just rang there, and it told me that the call was from Austria, but I have no idea who it was. That's old school technology, all right? That's about all I knew. I didn't know who was calling, so I wasn't going to take the call. Now, a couple more things to talk about. Netflix. Now, I know a bunch of our listeners have got themselves hooked up to Netflix, which there's definitely a few hoops to jump through to get into Netflix, because it's designed really for the US market. But we've got a page up there at nztechpodcast.com with the details on how to get into Netflix. But they've just launched, or they're in the process of launching, these individual user profiles. So at the moment, when I go into Netflix, it's just one profile for the whole family. So if my youngster's been watching kids programs, then it'll go up. It's going to start recommending that I might want to watch Thomas the Tank Engine or something like that, which doesn't actually fit with my personal TV and movie watching
preferences. Or at least that's what you'd like us to think.
But these new profiles mean you'll basically be able to log in with a different profile for each person, which will be nice. And quite unusual, actually, that it is it's a service that you don't pay a subscription per person. You do get that family subscription, and they're actually pushing it more in that direction. Whether they'll push their rates up in line with that after doing it, I guess we'll have to wait and see. And that may be something on their agenda at some point. But
I suspect finding that wider families, so Bill's paying for a subscription and his kids overseas are logging in as family members, and then it turns out that he's actually got a family of 85 people, that there'll be some issues around billing then.
Well, there are some limitations that I think it's, you can have two live streams at once. You can't have 85, so anyone with 85 kids, I think,
can't afford Netflix.
That might be true.
That's Brad and Angelina, isn't it?
In that case, they can afford Netflix.
Yeah.
I didn't know they had that many, but they could certainly afford them. Now, a couple of sort of business technology topics. Now, last week was the launch from SAP of their cloud offering into the New Zealand market. Now, Bill, you and I sort of went along and heard a little bit about this. What's your sort of? Can you give it a sort of a quick sum up on what SAP are doing? Doing here, and how that's relevant to New Zealand businesses.
Well, very quickly, SAP is big software for big companies is generally the is generally how you describe them, and they you know, the various bits linked together. If you've got a large company with a large number of departments and you're manufacturing and warehousing and, you know, have staff and so on, all the bits get come together with a big ERP package that you get from a company like SAP. But those packages cost tens of millions typically to install in sizable organizations. Projects can go on for quite a while, and they're just very scary to smaller organizations, because typically they might take a year or more to implement, and it's just not for anyone. In New Zealand, there's probably, I don't know, a few hundred potential customers at best for a company like that.
Mm.
By moving it to the cloud, all that becomes, I mean, all the infrastructure side of it just goes away. You just need a desktop to be able to get to it.
Yeah, because I mean, it's been such a big job to, for a business to install a system like SAP that, huge dollars involved, but delivered from the cloud. You just say, yeah, hey, we've got 20 users here that we want to be able to access your software, and they turn it on, you start using it.
And it's so many dollars per month per user, and the sums involved are not huge either. And so what happens is that kind of functionality can reach down to much smaller businesses. Now, there's a question of whether a small business actually needs that functionality or wants it, but there will be some who would and really realistically can't implement that or afford it at the moment. So for SAP, it probably trebles, quadruples, it certainly multiplies the size of the market that they can address, and it gives smaller companies an opportunity to get into their world. And they if you actually read their website, they're talking about companies with as few as 4 or 5 people using it.
Mm.
Well, when we were at the launch, that's not what the local people were saying. They were saying, well, realistically, we're talking upwards of 20 seats.
Yeah.
And they're certainly not going for the micro business. And I think that makes a lot of sense, actually.
Mm. And I mean, in New Zealand, there are lots and lots of businesses that fall well under that. But there's certainly a lot more businesses that are in that 20 range than those that are in the 500 plus or 100 plus, which is certainly probably where they would have been in the past. So yeah, I think the whole advent of cloud delivered services like this gives businesses more options that they wouldn't have had in the past. It's definitely a good thing.
I seem to remember them talking about something about an app store as well, which I kind of like the sound of that.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that looks. But obviously, it's a niche and very different to an iPhone app store. With what are they up to now? 900,000 apps, I think Apple was saying the other day they've got in their app store. It gives businesses more options for flexibility and customization and so on. Be able to use these tools that other people have put together.
And it brings the cloud a bit closer.
It does indeed. Now, also, talking about cloud technologies, Alistair, you and I were in Sydney yesterday, courtesy of the folks at Hewlett-Packard, to hear a little bit about what they're calling HP's converged cloud.
Yeah, so they've got a variety of different cloud products, and they've got some really nice management tools for dealing with it. So the cloud products they've got are aimed at businesses that need to have more computers, and they don't want to have to own them themselves. They want to pay for them as they use them, and they particularly don't want anything on their premises. They want the whole lot to belong to somebody else and be somebody else's problem.
Yeah. Now, I guess there's big players in the cloud era at the moment. Amazon, very well known for for businesses using their cloud services. Microsoft, Rackspace. There's a range of providers. I mean, what was it? That stood out to you about the offering from HP that is unique compared to those? Why would anyone look at what HP are doing when they're already a bunch of providers that have been in the market for some time and are pretty well respected?
No, there's a lot of providers for baked beans as well, but we still get to choose which ones we want. So what you've got to look for is the differentiation. Amazon has gone for a race to the bottom. They've gone to be the cheapest provider of a virtual machine you can have, which is great if you build your applications for disposable VMs. And there's plenty of space in the market of it for organizations that want something that's not a disposable VM, that feel they want, these are virtual machines, these are computers that run on top of clouds. They want something with a better quality of service. And we're definitely seeing differentiation in these cloud providers. And I think HP is playing a lot higher up in the cost and value chain than the Amazon end of things.
And don't forget that HP has a strong customer base here, which, you know, those people have a relationship with HP. They know what they're getting. Well, I mean, good and bad when they deal with them. And so, you know, it's nice for someone who's, say, a committed HP customer to be able to move to the cloud without actually having to go out and start again with relationships and so on.
And there's another piece to it as well, that HP don't just have this public cloud that sits in HP's data centers. The whole point about the converged cloud is that you could have a cloud that is actually in your premises, and that you get the agility and the speed of deployment benefits of cloud without actually having to ship all of your data to some data center somewhere remote. And then there's a third class that they called out, which I was surprised, you don't usually hear this one called out, which is the community cloud, where something like a group of organizations in the same market can choose to share a cloud infrastructure because they share services. Now, it could be things like local government's been really big on shared services for the last 10 years. That having an infrastructure on which multiple shared services could be run is a community cloud. And so they've thought through multiple cloud use. Same interface to manage the whole thing, the ability to take what you've built on premises in your own offices and push it out to a public cloud, or go in the reverse, have your dev and test environment to the public and pull it back into your private cloud when you run into production.
And they were talking about the converged cloud consisting of, you know, I guess standard ways of being able to do a broad variety of things. So as you say, it might be they need a server to do one thing. Could be on your premises, could be somewhere else, could be in their cloud. But even to the extent, because they've gone down this the open approach to it, is maybe you actually, you know, we'll use these same tools to actually push it out to somebody else's cloud that's nothing to do with HP, but, you know, there are going to be consistent methods of being able to interact with the cloud. So
did they talk about the kit at all?
Don't, because you shouldn't care. As the consumer of the cloud, you should be buying a service level, not a piece of tin. Of course, they're not going to build it on somebody else's tin. It's all built on HP hardware that you could buy from the shops.
But they do have some quite interesting new hardware if you want that localized cloud, don't they? There was a particular rather a small server that they were showing off.
Were you thinking the microserver? Or were you thinking Moonshot?
Moonshot.
Moonshot's a very cool thing. So this is, instead of what we in conventional enterprise IT tends to be, build up a big infrastructure that is universally accessible but is quite expensive because of that universal accessibility, particularly shared storage kind of structures, and virtualization builds on top of that and has caused lots of this to be deployed out. Moonshot goes completely the other way. And they say in these rack mount server enclosures that in the past would hold one server, we can now put 45. They're all small, relatively low power servers. So they use currently Atom CPUs or ARM CPUs instead of the big Xeons.
They're smaller than a laptop, aren't they? These servers
they're holding your hand kind of size.
They probably look like Ultrabooks.
They slot into
And they're so condensed that they actually have to take some of the frame out to have space to put a hard drive in it. And it's a 2.5-inch hard drive. So these things are pretty small. And the next generation is going to be even smaller. Yeah. But the point about them is that they do a single task. They are oriented towards being things like web servers, where you want a sea of web servers to provide your service, rather than one stonking big one where everything fails when it falls over.
Isn't it interesting how these things go in cycles?
Absolutely. Yeah. Everything in IT is cyclic.
Yeah.
Well, I think that actually probably that runs us to the end. We're out of time. But I think we've actually covered a fair bit this time around. So, and we've thrown in a bit of business and enterprise technology discussion, which we don't often delve into. So I enjoyed that. Thank you both for coming on the show. Now, Alistair, where do we track you down online? You're on Twitter.
So my brand is Demitas, which is my company name. So you can find me as Demitas NZ, and you can find me at demitas.co.nz as my primary blog. I've got a number of other outputs that you can find from there.
Great, that's good. And Bill, tell us about digital.
Well, I'm moving from billbennett.co.nz to digital slowly. Probably take me a couple of months to make the transition.
But you're still on Twitter at BillBennettNZ.
Yep. And will be for the foreseeable. And as I say, as I said earlier, we're rolling out slowly, getting into the news gathering and getting the ball moving. Should be at speed by the end of August. And hopefully there'll be a lot of stories coming out. I'm hoping to write 3 or 4 a day.
That's good. Well, looking forward to that. And, of course, you can find links to all of our Twitter handles, and mine is just at Paul Spain. But you can find those at nztechpodcast.com. And we like to be liked on facebook.com/nztechpodcast. We're on Twitter at nztechpodcast. And you can also find us on Google Plus as well. And you'll find NZ Tech on LinkedIn. So we're where you are, I guess you could say, if you happen to be anywhere as far as social media is concerned. Otherwise, you can just listen to us through iTunes or at nztechpodcast.com. So hopefully people can find us. And there's always Google if you get lost. But the fact that people are listening in anyway, I think we've been found. So, hey, thanks everyone for joining us again. Now we will be back next week at the probably the more usual slot of being published sometime on a Tuesday evening. This week we're a little bit delayed with the Sydney trip. Throwing some spanner in the works, and do look out for our new business podcast, the NZ Business Podcast. All right, catch ya. Bye.